The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, kind of the background or foundation for the teachings here at IMC are the teachings of the Buddha, and they're preserved in a large body of literature that's filled with the use of metaphor, allegory, simile, puns, word plays, poetry, evocative imagery, lots of different kind of what we call literary effects to kind of bring something alive for people. And so it's a little bit hard sometimes to read them if you've kind of been introduced to Buddhism through later interpretations, because sometimes things that were metaphors later on were taken to be realities. And so, you know, it's a little bit, you know. So one of them is, interesting one word, is the word samsara. And I think many people are familiar with the word, like, it's not as well known as nirvana, but the two are often considered to be a pair, samsara and nirvana. Nibbana, and in more recent decades or centuries, the word samsara has come to mean in Buddhism a place. The place is this crazy world that we live in, and so the solution, because the world is crazy place, is to get out of this world, and so the idea is to have nirvana, and that kind of, you know, logic, nirvana is a transcendent place. It's really a place removed other than this world here. And so often there's a kind of geographic, it's seen as a geographic term. Samsara is here, nirvana is there. In the earliest usage of the term, samsara meant to wander, like to travel about, to wander. And that it wasn't a place, but it was an activity. It was an action of wandering, just on and on and on, the endless wandering. And was that wandering supposed to be meant as a metaphor, a simile, an allegory? Was it? How are we supposed to understand it? Regardless of what it was used originally, that the whole literature was meant to be evocative and suggestive, and so I think we're allowed some liberties to see, you know, how it, what it evokes in us here in our life. And I think that it's fairly easy to see that many human beings are wandering through their life. There's a stream of one thing after the other, chasing a dream, chasing after this hope, this expectation. This is the thing that's going to do it. There's a story of Mullah Nasruddin, who has a basket of peppers, green peppers or red peppers, and red peppers, right? So he's eating them, he's sitting there eating them, and each one is super hot, and these tears running down his eyes and his face, and he's like, you know, goes for another one. It's just like he's clearly suffering a lot. And someone says to him, you know, why are you doing that? You know, it's hurting you, and you're in pain. And, oh, but I've been told that some of them in the basket are sweet. So the next one will be sweet. The next one, you know, so the next one will do it for me. And so, you know, I don't know what the next one is. The next, you know, the next lottery is the one I'm going to win. The next, you know, job I get will be the job. The next partner I have will be the partner. The next, you know, go. It's always something. You know, wandering, looking, the next TV show. Although I watched 100 TV shows, they were awful, awful. But the next one will do it. You know, just, I'm sure. You know, it's always, you know. So people are wandering, looking for something, wanting something, trying to run away from something. And there's this constant, incessant wandering going on. And you see that in the mind, most particularly, the wandering of our thoughts. The thoughts that are wanting, that going to the next thing and that thing and running away from this and going after that and going to the next thing and trying to figure it out and have expectations and hopes and, you know, just endless, endless. And this ancient kind of metaphor for this simile is that of monkeys swing through the forest and the branches of the trees. And I haven't studied monkeys to know if this is how they do it, but they're swinging kind of fast. And so they, by the time they grab onto one branch, they're already swinging over to grab the next and the next. And so this incessant going after something, going after something. And a fascinating place to see the wandering of the mind, the incessant searching for the mind or pursuing thoughts of the mind, being in this endless stream of thoughts and kind of swimming in it and going after it and going along with it, is on meditation retreats. And because in ordinary life, your thinking gets interrupted a lot. And so you're having some, you know, grand old thought and you're involved, or a terrible thought and you're involved in doing it. And then the car in front of you suddenly veers and, you know, veers out and puts a brake on, and suddenly you have to stop, and there goes your thoughts for that moment. And so reality is constantly interrupting. But on meditation retreats, there's very little interruptions. You're sitting for 45 minutes at a time, like we did, you know, just now. And then you get up quietly, no one's talking. And after a while, the routine is really routine. It's like you're walking meditation, you're sitting meditation. Maybe the big entertainment is a meal. That's the interruption. And then you know, and so you're left to yourself much more than people usually are. And one of the advantages of that is to see how the mind is functioning. Just watch and see how incessant it's flowing and wandering and going on and on and on and on. And I once spent 3 days on retreat in a fantasy. And I couldn't stop it. I didn't want it. I didn't exactly want it, but it was very pleasant and wonderful. It was all kinds of plans, and how it involved business plans, and, you know, so I was creating this, whatever. And it took me 3 days to get sick of it. That's, you know, I'm a slow learner or something. And, you know, give me a break. But it had all this promise and hope, and it was very pleasant what it was going to do for me. And so I was pulled into its world. And so that is samsara. That's wandering on and on and on. And so the simile that goes along with this idea of samsara is that of a river. You're in the river and you're flowing on and on, and it just goes on forever. And then, you know, might be in the river, floating in the river, and then these wonderful boats come by, or terrible boats come by, and you find yourself on a boat, and for a long time you're on one boat, and it's spectacular at first, but after a while, you know, you've seen all the shows that the showboat has, and you're doing a rerun after a rerun or something. So get me off this boat. Or you get on the great warships, and you're fighting the great battle until the battle never ends. It just goes on and on and on. Or you're in this poor, decrepit little raft that barely survives, and that's when you stay on really long because you feel so sorry for yourself and so much self-pity, poor me. And so it's very, you know, so we get on these different rafts, but the thing is we keep floating. It just goes on and on and on. And some things are very promising. This boat down there, that'll do it for me. And so we get on boats. But what we don't see is it's more of the same. It goes on and on and on. Samsara just flows on, and we wander on and on and on. And so... You know, is that a depressing news that Buddhism has? You know, or is it? I don't think so, because especially when people do a lot of meditation, it just after a while it starts to be kind of tiring. The incessant wandering, incessant going and going and flowing of these thoughts and ideas and concerns and fears and desires and ambitions, and enough already. So then, there's an alternative that Buddhism offers. And the kind of metaphor that's used for finding that alternative is to go to the other shore. So to go across the river to the other shore, don't go with the river and keep flowing, and come to safety on the other side, cross the river and come to the other side. And that also has lent itself to kind of a bifurcation of the world Because again, anytime you have these geographical metaphors, it's like a place, and so a place, it's that place, it's there, it's over there. And this, where I am now, that's not good. I have to get there. And there can be sometimes in Buddhism a kind of rejection of ordinary life because there's this other place we're supposed to go, the other shore. But, you know, the other shore is nowhere else but here. It's not, you're not going anywhere. It's here. But it's here where you already are without incessantly flowing onward and onward, without incessantly seeking and wanting or protecting and building. And after a while, you know, it's not incessantly building up a self, not incessantly defending a self, not incessantly proving a self and justifying a self and blaming a self and feeling sorry for self. This whole kind of construct of self is part of the, in Buddhism, is considered part of the samsara, part of the wandering. We wander into these identities, these ideas of who we are. It goes on, and there's no end to it. Part of the challenge with being caught up in the wandering with all kinds of ideas of self is that some of them are good ideas. They're good boats. You know, they float well, they do good things. But it's just more of this flowing, and just more of this kind of being caught in something, this idea of self. And so to go across to the other shore, but really the shore is here. And in the beginning, what we do is we get a foothold on the other shore. And if you can get a foothold and stand someplace and stand on the other, because you're close to the other shore, the water is shallow enough, then you can, you know, begin, you're safe from the currents, and you can maybe stand your ground, and the currents won't keep pushing you downstream. And so from there, you can make your way back up to where it's really safe above the water. And I have this fantasy, and you know, my kind of construct of this whole image is, it turns out we've been floating for millennia, long time. But it turns out, if we didn't know it, it turns out the water is only 3 feet deep. It's very strong, but it's only 3 feet deep. And all we had to do was stand upright, and then our feet reaches the ground. And then we have a foothold, and we can stand there. But in any case, on the other shore, near the other shore, we can get a foothold, we can stand. And then when we stand firmly there, then the current still flows. But it flows past us and by us. We're not carried along by it. So there's a way of standing, being upright, metaphorically, that the mind, the emotions, all these thoughts, the selfing that goes on, continues. But we're kind of standing still in the middle of it, and it doesn't push us around. We're not caught by it. We just watch it go by. It goes and goes and goes. And there's a kind of freedom from it. It's clear that we're watching it go, but we're not flowing in it. We're not participating anymore. We're not jumping in on that boat and that boat. We see the boats go by. Well, that was a nice thought, but bye. You know, oh, that's a terrible thought. Oh, okay. You know, just kind of, oh, there it goes, here it comes. Emotions and feelings, just let them go by. It's a radically different way of living, of being, than allowing yourself to keep floating on and on and on. And so all you need is a foothold to begin that process of being free. So what's the foothold? And I think you have to have, ideally have two, so you have one for each foot. You know, you put down. So I think that there's two, I think of two footholds which are really invaluable. The simplest one, at least in principle, is the simple act of mindfulness. There's something about awareness when it's clear, when it's specific, that really recognizes, oh, this is what's happening now. This is what's going on now. When it has enough clarity around it, then the awareness is not flowing with what it's aware of. when it's really clear, awareness isn't part of the reaching out to grab it or push it away or contract around it. If the mindfulness is really clear, the mindfulness is independent of what it's mindful of. The knowing is free of what is known. Awareness is more spacious and open, and some people say receptive, to what's happening as opposed to somehow entangled with it. And in that moment of that kind of clear seeing, clear knowing, there is a foothold in awareness. We're not in the stream anymore. We're not swimming in the stream, pushing around by it. But to do that, and this is part of the art of mindfulness, it helps to have a specific recognition of what's happening. It's very easy, I think, to have life be just one big soup of a river, just flowing, all this stuff. And it's hard to see that all these different things are happening. And they're all kind of mixed up together. So I might have a judgment about something happening. Maybe I'm judging the river. The river is muddy today. I'm getting dirty. And we're still in the river flowing along. But my reaction to the muddy river, not liking it, is just kind of all kind of in the soup together, and it's not any different than the river and me. And so I'm, you know, it's you know, who I am, what the judgment is, what the river is. It's all kind of in a soup. It's kind of like not really seen as being distinct. But to have this mindfulness that's distinct, oh, there's the river. There's recognizing that it's dirty. There's my discomfort with it. There's a judgment that that's not nice. It shouldn't be that way. I don't like that. And here's me saying, I don't like it. I just invented I for the moment, as opposed to just dislike. There's I dislike it. And to be able to kind of, and when you see it with that kind of specificity, then the awareness has a better chance of not being entangled in the soup, caught up in it. And that's where we can get a foothold, step back, and then we can start watching the current go by. The second foothold is ethical integrity. To stand on our ethical goodness, our intention to not cause harm, to not intentionally cause harm, to not deliberately cause harm. And so without some modicum of feeling good about yourself, some modicum of feeling a certain kind of self-worth, certain self-dignity, self-valuing, self-appreciation, for the idea that we're doing the best we can here to some degree to live a good ethical life, then you'll only get one foothold, and you won't be so, you need two to really kind of stay balanced and not be pushed around by the river. And so maybe, I suspect that a high percentage of you here, if not the whole, certainly the whole group as a whole, are probably more ethical than you give yourself credit for. You probably didn't kill anyone today. You probably didn't rob any banks today. You probably didn't, I hope you didn't get in sexual misconduct today. That's a little bit, you know, that's a little more popular. And I hope you didn't lie today. That's even more popular, and you know. And I hope that you didn't involve yourself in intoxicants. It's kind of interesting how they seemingly sometimes get more and more popular as you go down through the list. But even so, you might have been, your intention is to live a good life, not harm anyone, and you're trying your best. Trying your best counts for a lot for getting a foothold and to feel somehow, feel the goodness of that, feel how it hopefully comes from a place of self-worth, of dignity, of goodness, of value, of some kind of inner beauty, something really nice. And many people don't have the habit, don't have the training, don't have the, never been given the instructions to take and cherish and value your ethical goodness. Cultivate it. Use it as a refuge. Stand on it. Take a foothold on it. And let that be here. And it's a lot easier to stand still in the middle of the flow of life and the flow of all this incessant going on if you have kind of, you don't, you're not kind of wobbly around your ethics or feel like you have to defend it or protect it or hide it or do all these different things. So those two things, we stand on that firm ground. And then let all the flow, the wandering go on without us feeding it and fueling it. Because we're talking mostly about the mind, as the mind begins to does this and it's no longer caught in feeding it, it begins to quiet down. It begins to get quieter, and the flow becomes weaker, and as it gets weaker, we see it more clearly. We feel the independence from it, the freedom of it, and we stand our ground. We don't get pushed around, and we just let it flow and flow, and it quiets and quiets. And so holding ourselves in a certain kind of upright way, still in the middle of whatever's going on, lets everything else quiet down. And then a remarkable reversal goes on. And that is that first we're holding ourselves kind of still with our awareness and attention, just being there and watching everything. And as everything else gets quieter and quieter around you, this river quiets down, becomes stiller and stiller, what starts becoming more alive, more luminous in a sense, is that awareness. That stillness no longer feels still exactly, but feels free, feels light, feels liberated in some way. Until at some point, we've managed to get up to the other shore where the mind or the heart is not pushed around by anything. The mind is not, the heart is not caught in the swirls, the eddies of desire and aversion and fears and doubts and ambition and all these different things. So the main point I wanted to say was this idea that we want to get a foothold. And in our tradition, there are these two footholds that are very valuable: the mindfulness foothold and the ethical foothold. And the mindfulness foothold is not over there, the other shore there, but it's here, where you are, when you can clearly know, oh, this is what's happening. Oh, now I see. Let me tune into this and see it really clearly. And in that clarity of knowing, oh, this is what's happening. It's a very ordinary, it's a very simple activity of the mind. It's not like a complicated rocket science kind of thing. It's very ordinary, but it's ordinary done with clarity and specificity and, oh, this is what's happening. This is an in-breath. Oh, this is an out-breath. This is a thought. This is mind out of control. Oh, this is the mind out of control. You can feel yourself leaning into that out of control mind, being about to be swept away again. And then you view it more emphatically. You bring in more clarity. This is a mind out of control. Until you finally, and you watch it, but you're not it. And there's a kind of freedom in that. So, samsara. Samsara is the endless wandering. And nirvana is when the wandering stops. And that's pretty cool. It said that when the wandering stops, when we're on the other shore, that's the greatest safety. And sometimes it's a metaphor of the river, because that can be kind of romantic and nice, river flowing down. they often use the metaphor of it's a flood. And floods are much more dangerous. So the idea is we want to get out of the flood to the shore to safety. And so nirvana is safety. So those are my little thoughts for today. So do you have any questions about anything, about what I said or about anything else? You're welcome to ask.
Thank you for your talk. I don't know how to ask this, but it has to do with what ambition is. And the description you have of the river and having that be a mind activity, I feel really confused about the about using my practice to move forward with choices in my life, and the choices to act often feel like they revolve around ambition or having a desire to see something happen. And when I hear you speak about the footholds and the going to the other shore, I start judging my choices, thinking, well, I'm just wasting my life because what I really should be doing is just sitting and going for nirvana. So I get really tangled up in confusion uh-huh. around what is right life and uh-huh. Being comfortable with my ambition.
Great. It was well said. Thank you. And so it's a little bit delicate thing to answer a question without two people deciding what their shared understanding of words are, like ambition. Generally, when I think of ambition, and I think Buddhists maybe, that it involves some kind of attachment, some kind of greed for something to happen. The alternative to having ambition is to have vision about what's possible, or an aspiration. An aspiration, I think of as something which doesn't have any greed or attachment to it. It could be a great vision of something worthwhile to pursue. And a person might put a lot of energy and passion into it, but they're not attached to the outcome. They're not attached to having it happen. It's like, you know, if it happens, great, I'll put my effort into it. Ambition is often associated, I think, with it being personal ambition. It's for me. Sometimes we talk about ambition for my family or ambition for someone else, but it's often very much closely tied to being one's self-identity issues and egotism and selfishness. That I think that's why some people have trouble with the word, the idea, thinking ambition is a good thing because of that association. Regardless of how we understand the word ambition, where our motivation comes from inside is one of the important topics. If I like to think that there's a surface mind. The surface mind is a place of anxiety and worry and social pressures and you know, egotistical kind of self-identity thing that goes on and trying to get praise and, you know, the whole world of things that goes on the surface. And I think of it as surface because often it comes with a lot of thinking. And that's where the incessant flow of thinking is often operating. And how meditation can help with all this is not to let you live in blissful retirement on the edge of the river, but rather if you could drop the quiet, the surface mind, all that chatter, and you know, and be able to discover a place of peace that's deeper, where ambition has been put aside for the time being. Fear has been put aside. All kinds of things have been put aside temporarily, like a vacation, a break, and really settle into a deeper place within. Then there's a deeper reference point for knowing what's important. And there might still be motivations coming from that place, but that's coming from a deeper place that feels like it has more integrity, or feels like it is more real, or closer to the core values we want to live by. I've known people who have been ambitious to do things, and they succeeded, and only then did they realize this was a waste of time. You know, I was doing this really to get my parents' approval. It turns out they didn't care. So this idea of going to the shore or letting the incessant flow quiet is not meant to be end up being quietescent or peaceful or doing nothing. Hopefully it gives us access to much deeper wellsprings of motivation, of aspiration, of vision, of knowing what's possible and knowing what's most important for us. That make sense?
It does.
Is this on?
Yeah.
This is two halves of a one question, where someone said that the intention to have compassion is enough. I may not actually feel it, but the intention is strong. It's a long way toward it. But a deeper aspect of that I was introduced to just recently is the Bodhisattva vow. And I always thought of it as a thing that, only Bodhisattvas take Bodhisattva vows. But I, can I say what I think that is?
Please.
I vow to live for the benefit of all living beings. It's very simple. But I've taken that to heart to mean that the intention of that vow is the same thing, that you have that intention to live that. Could you speak to that double-sided question?
Well, certainly intention is valuable, and that's many times is where it begins. And so to only have intention and not act on it ever, you know, it's kind of nice for that intentional part of us. But, you know, it's, I don't know how far it'll take us. But that's where it begins, and it counts for a lot. And so have the intention to be compassionate, you know, not because you're going to become wealthy, but because there's some kind of movement in the heart, some kind of feeling or sense inside that really feels right. This is my hope. I can't do it now, but it's my hope to do that someday. I like to kind of celebrate that comes from a good place inside, and we want to appreciate that and value that and care for that, and then perhaps over time that intention can grow. If that intention to be compassionate has a little bit bigger, you know, vision to it, that it's really you want to live a life that supports all people. Generally, the Bodhisattva vow comes, people make this kind of commitment, this vow, when they have a clear sense that nothing else makes sense except somehow being open in service for the welfare of all beings. And they might not be able to do it, but it's the only thing that makes sense. And so the intention, this is what I aspire to do. And then, you know, ideally we try to save all beings. But, you know, you're not going to get around that many of them. But it's pretty beautiful, pretty wonderful. That's what people are living for, and letting that kind of good-heartedness come out. Is that an adequate answer to you?
Very good.
Great, thank you. So, yeah.
Thanks. So this has all been very relevant to what I've been thinking about recently, what I've been going through. But basically, I feel as though society does not encourage you to follow your passions necessarily. It's not something, in a lot of cases, where you can actually build a good foundation.
That's why there are starving artists.
Of course.
For example.
Yeah. And there's probably fewer of them here than there were before.
Yeah, they can't afford to live here.
Right. So
they go somewhere else and starve.
To starve, yeah, exactly. yeah. So, as a young person, I can't help but feel a lot of trepidation about the future, because it's like, it can be very discouraging. So if you take the metaphor of a person standing in a river, the sea level is rising, you know, no pun intended,
but also kind of,
the sea level is rising.
Oh, that way, yeah.
I actually did intend that pun, but, so yeah, it's just, it feels like, I mean, I'm sure humans have always had a lot of resistance or they've been faced with a lot, but I feel as though this is a very unique situation. I'm sure everything is unique, but, this just seems like it's really forceful in the direction that is not conducive to being a happy human.
Well, then if that's how you see it, the only way you're going to have some degree of happiness, well-being, is to do something about it.
Yeah.
And, and if that's not popular, passion, don't listen to the popular voice. Unless they're giving you good advice about how to do it. Because, you know, there can be a lot of wasted effort in that regard. But,
yeah.
But the more strongly you feel about what's happening in the world and the suffering in the world, you know, the more important, doing anything else but respond to it is not a good alternative. And if you really are dedicated to doing something about it, then you might discover what a waste of time it is to be afraid. What a waste of time it is to be dismayed. Because we have much better things to do than be afraid.
Yeah. Thank you.
The first foothold, you said you should observe the knowing without the knowledge.
No. We should clearly know without being caught in what we know, without being entangled with it.
Would you clarify this? How would you practice this?
Oh, I'm looking at you, and you seem to have a very nice blue shirt, and I wish I had a shirt like that, and I wonder if I could maybe trade, or I wonder, you know, I'd see how much money, yeah. And so I know you have a blue shirt, but, you know, me and that shirt, we're meant to be. I'm entangled with it, right? I'm caught with that. But if I kind of sit here and take a few minutes and calm down and breathe, and oh, Gil, what's going on? A shirt, desire. Oh, there's desire. Let's just know the desire. I want that shirt. I don't really want it, so don't don't give it to me. And then I sit and I get quieter, and I say, oh, quieter. Oh, desire. There's desire. I have a desire, but I don't have to do anything with the desire. In the past, I always had to act on my desire. There was this authority around desire. This is new. I have a desire for the shirt. I see it. So I see the desire. and I can see it without acting on it or being with it. Wow, look at this desire. And then I get quieter and I see, oh, look at that. Quietly. I have this belief that if I can have that shirt, more people will like me. And it's really about getting feeling, I want people to like me and all this stuff. And I didn't know that until I got quiet and saw. And then I see, I want people to like me because of my clothes. And then I'm not entangled with that, you know. Then I just, oh, look, that's thing. It's like looking at something out there. As opposed to, I want people to like me. When that shirt doesn't work, let's find another one. Does that make sense? I'm just making this up, so. Okay. Sometimes I don't know if these little scenarios, you know, explain it better than a rational argument.
Excellent, thank you.
Great, thank you. I like your shirt, but I don't want it. Okay, so get a foothold and trust it. And let everything else go deep. Let yourself, it's a way of really allowing, you know, the metaphors change, right? I love the metaphor deep. The river just keeps you on the surface of your life. The foothold allows you to drop in deep and discover what's really going on. And then you might discover powerful motivations and intentions. And I think if there's really deeply in you, the motivation, the intention to do something, it really feels integral and deep inside of you, and it's not going to cause any harm, but maybe the opposite. Take your chance. Become a starving activist. Thank you.